On today's episode, we're chatting with Ellie, who is a foster and adoptive parent in rural Utah. Come take a listen and see how she's found resources and tools, even in a small town.
This is Fostering Conversations with Utah Foster Care, where we have insightful conversations about parenting for bio, foster, adopted, or blended families to better understand the experiences we all face as families. Welcome to Fostering Conversations. I'm your host, Amy Smith. Today we have Ellie, who is a foster parent in Utah. Thanks for joining us, Ellie.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
So we will just get started by having you introduce yourself a little bit so that our listeners know who they're listening to today.
My name is Ellie, and my husband and I, we've been married for 22 years, and we started our foster journey with Utah Foster Care in 2018. Since then, we've had 22 children come through our home. We have 5 biological children. We adopted 5 children also during that time. And right now, we are on a pause after our last adoption. And in a few months, we're hoping to jump right back in.
Holy cow. Okay, that's amazing. I love it. I've adopted but 5, holy cow, on top of another 5. That's impressive.
I made it up to 10.
You sure did. So are the 5 that you adopted all biological siblings?
No, we did an adoption of a 15-year-old and then a 1.5-year-old that we had placed with us since he was born.
Okay.
And then we did 3 biological siblings last August.
Okay. So 3 separate adoptions then.
Yes.
Okay. Wow. Okay. That's amazing. So something that I think makes you even more unique is that you live in a rural town in Utah.
I would have to double check the population, but it is very small. We live in Hilldale, Utah. I believe around 6,000 to 7,000 people. There is a 1 school location.
Okay.
For where we're at. And they run preschool all the way to 12 on their same location.
Wow.
And it's about 45 minutes to Walmart and a little over an hour to the mall.
Holy cow. Okay. So tell us, where are the kids that you are caring for? Where are they coming from? What towns are they coming from?
We received placements from St. George and Cedar City, mostly. We had a lot from Cedar City. And then even as far as Manti, the sibling set of 3 was from Manti. And then the first adoption that we had was Native Ikwa from Tula.
So something, the immediate thought I had when you said 45 minutes to Walmart is, what do you do when they call you with a placement? Do you have everything on hand? Because I personally run to Walmart the second I get a call or do a Target pickup order.
Yes, I actually just did my first Walmart delivery order last night because they opened it up to our area. I was really excited.
And your life
But typically, yes, it was amazing. I felt like I didn't tip enough.
I love it.
But we have a local thrift store here that has a lot of vouchers, and they were really helpful when we would get last minute calls. So I'd call them, hey, I have somebody coming in 30 minutes. Can I see what you have? But then we also have quite an extensive stock with the totes and the clothing and fresh underwear and diapers of all the different sizes. We have quite the storage area.
I never stored anything, but it's because I'm 10 minutes from a Walmart and, you know, any delivery service can show up. So that is a different perspective for sure.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about the 15-year-old that you adopted. When did they come into care to you? How did that journey look?
She came to us. She was placed in a rehab. She struggled with alcoholism from the age of 10 to 15. She was in a rehab. And her tribe did not have the monetary means to continue keeping her in a level 6 residential. And it happened to be right here in our town. We're very rural. And one thing that our RFC liked, we've got a lot of teenagers that had propensities to run off. Mm-hmm. Because when you're this far out, there's not really anywhere you can run to. And everybody knows if you're the new kid at Ellie's house.
That's hilarious.
No. It did help a lot with keeping tabs and keeping eyes. But she was close to finishing the program and looking at needing another residential home. And we had just leveled to level 3 in our home. So we met her and they went ahead with the placement there. And then we ended up adopting her. Wow. Okay. And so for listeners that don't know, saying level six, that's a pretty high needs child.
And yeah, level six is residential.
Yeah. And you saying you became licensed as a level three. That's, I think, the highest that a foster family can be licensed as. And that it just essentially means that you're more qualified to deal with behaviors, different, maybe higher levels of trauma exposure. But just to give a tiny bit of context to listeners that maybe don't know that. So what made you guys want to be foster parents?
Both of my parents were involved in the foster system as foster children themselves.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that left a big impact on me. Hearing my mom talk about her CASA worker that she used when she was really young, and then having my dad had actually ran away from his placement and he skipped countries. It was a very interesting story. But seeing, I come from a large family. There are eight kids in our family. I'm the oldest of eight children, and my husband, his mom has 17 children.
Woo!
And yes, natural biological children, no twins.
Wow.
So we were raised in really large families, and we both really loved the dynamic. And I'm trying to think of the year. It would have been 17 years ago. We lived in Nebraska, and we both had the thought, let's become foster parents. And we went through the program, we got licensed, our house study came through. And right before we were open for placements, my husband hesitated. And I think it's a really important message to have out there for people that are contemplating fostering, is that you both have to be 100% on the same page from the first day. If there's hesitation or something doesn't feel right to one of you, it will not make for a smooth journey. And I'm really glad that we listened to each other and we paused, put it on the back burner, and life took us all over the place in the next few years. So when we finally came back to Utah, he brought it up and said, I think we should do that again. And I was just waiting. I was waiting for him to feel like it was a good idea. So it took about 13 years of life in between that initial first, let's get licensed when we were almost there, and then when we both were completely 100% on the same page. And I asked my husband, what is it that changed for you? I wish he was here to share with this too. But he told me that his view of being a father shifted from, I have all that I can handle and I need to focus on what I have right now, to if other children need to have a father figure in their life, who else is going to step up? You don't have to be perfect in order to step in. So that's what changed his line of thinking. And he is amazing.
No, I love that. I think that's a really important aspect, because there are so many times where one spouse wants to be a foster parent and one doesn't, and they give in, and it's not good. It's not good. You're exactly right. You have to both be on the same page.
Yes. And I've seen instances where there's been a call for replacement and one spouse will be 100% for it and the other one has hesitations and they're not on the same page, and more disruption that way.
Absolutely. I mean, even when we shut down our license a few years ago, I did not want to shut it down. And my husband's like, it's time. Like, we're done. And it was so hard for me, but it would have been so much harder if we kept going and my husband was done and I wasn't, you know? And so it's so important. Even though it's hard, you do have to be on the same page. I agree with you. I think that's really important.
100%. Yep. It comes every single day. You have to be on the same page you're parenting with.
So let's talk a little bit more about the rural aspect, because I think that's a unique aspect that we don't always get to talk to people about. You talked about that you have this thrift store that helps you a lot. What type of community do you guys have around you that also lends or maybe doesn't lend support to you? I don't know.
The fostering journey was or is definitely the most isolating. I would honestly say that the adoption journey is even more isolating than the fostering journey. We tend to get more support when we're on the foster side. And then after adoption, it's, oh, okay, you're fine. That's you don't good. Need any more resources. Your kids are magically better.
Yeah, yeah.
I do have a few friends here in the community that are amazing and go-getters. And, oh, you need that. Let me find out how to find it. It's really important to know who your village is, even before you step in. Just like having major life-changing surgery, before you step in to majorly change your family, it's important to know who you have on your team. The local doctor here is amazing. So he didn't mind all of the appointments that I would have to line up really quick. And he listens really well and doesn't blink twice when the paperwork is, I don't know.
Exactly. Yes.
That is a huge help. We have a local church community that is really supportive too. And that has made a world of difference. The school that is here, it is very small. I have had so many parents talk to me and tell me all of their frustrations and struggles with IEPs and getting children into the school in the area they're at, and it's nightmare after nightmare. And I will say that I don't know if it, the benefit of being smaller. So the first grade classroom has 12 to 15 children. So when my son has a, he's had level 2 autism and he's in the regular classroom, and when something triggers a trauma and he's on the floor screaming, they have the resources and the people in the one-on-one to be able to help and take care of that. They have been really, really great with testing and IEPs. If I have a question, it's, oh, let's do a meeting there, and they step in. So it's nice to have a smaller school for that purpose. And then also for the teenagers, when I get a call from the secretary, hey, I was here this morning and now they're not. I'm like, thank you for the heads up. Let me go figure that out.
I love it. That's amazing. I think those are really amazing perks that really you don't have in these bigger communities. So that's really neat. Are you guys the only foster family in your town?
Yes. There was a kinship family a couple of years ago, but it was a very directed case. The only foster parents that have been in Hilldale. Our town is unique because it runs on the Arizona-Utah line. So half of the town in Hilldale and then the other half on the Arizona side. And there's one amazing foster dad on the Arizona side.
Okay, but he's getting all placements from Arizona. They don't cross the border.
That's correct. Yep, they can't cross the border. So I've helped him with childcare and we go back and forth. We're on each other's villages.
Yeah.
But that's the only other one here.
I assumed that was the case, but I think it's interesting to know. So what would you say, as it sounds like you've adopted a teenager, you've said that you have a child with level 2 autism. What would you say are things that helped prepare you for these types of moments in your life, adopting a teenager with a lot of trauma background, adopting a child? I assume the child that is,
yes,
has autism is adopted. That was a bad assumption, but I did assume that. But what types of classes or skills or qualities even that you just innately have helped you to be a successful foster parent and adoptive parent to kids with these higher needs?
Yes, we have had a lot of higher needs. If I remember correctly, a newborn that I had was the only level 1 that was placed with us and quickly moved into higher levels as he got older. TBRI is hands down one of the best trainings that's offered through Utah Foster Care. My husband and I have done it 3 times. We plan on doing it again. Every time we do, there's something else that comes up that is just invaluable. The patience and consistency that is taught by that is something that we use every second of every day. Also being really informed as far as autism and RAD, we've had from the first placement that we had until March of last year, so that's about 7 years, we had at least 1, if not 3 children with reactive attachment disorder in our home.
Holy cow.
Yes. There are some people that will argue that it is rare. I will argue that it is definitely not rare, especially in our circles.
Yes.
And I think that is one thing that I've seen disruptions come from is a lack of information and a lack of resources available for children with RAD and for children with higher needs. With the level 2 autism, I cannot speak the praise of ABA therapy.
Is that the one that comes into your home or do you go somewhere for that one?
We do both. We do in-center and in-home. It's applied behavior analysis. And they do in-home and in-office. It's compassionate ABA. There are 2 different types. One is gone out of favor, and this one is very much child-led. It's very gentle. And even placements that I've had for a short amount of time with autism, I have put them in an ABA program, and they make huge strides. And it's made reunification a little bit easier in several circumstances. Even We had one child that had RAD that was approved for ABA therapy also, and we did see improvement there too. Very great resource to have, and it is all over Utah. We travel 30 minutes for the closest center. George, Cedar, Salt Lake, there are, not sure about Manti. I think there was one in Manti, but ABA is great. I think one of the biggest successful tools is that my husband and I are on the same team. Yeah. On the same page. That's huge, especially with excessive trauma. Any trauma is excessive.
You're right. But yes.
Extreme trauma and RAD, or not so much autism, but you see a lot of children that will try to sabotage the relationships of people around them. Yes, you know what I'm talking about.
I can point a specific child that I had in my home.
Exactly. I think, if we're honest, I think all of us have had at least one, if not many. And they don't feel safe when their environment is safe.
Yes.
And making sure that you and your partner, your husband, your wife are completely on the same page. And that while it is healthy for your children to know that you do disagree and that you work around, sometimes it is even more important that they don't see disagreement. So we do. Yeah, we do a lot of our disagreeing privately. So let's talk about that, and then we'll hold it for later. Mm-hmm. To be a unified front in front of the children is stabilizing and consistent. Yeah. And I think it's very necessary.
Well, and so many times kids that are in foster care, if they see a disagreement, they're immediately thinking someone's going to get punched, someone's going to become drunk. Like, they are going to worst case scenario immediately.
Yep.
Because that's what they've seen. They're not just thinking, they can just, talk about this peacefully and have different opinions. They're thinking, I'm not going to be safe here pretty soon. What do I do?
Exactly.
So that's a really good perspective and point to make. I like that a lot. Do you feel like these resources, are they things that you've had to seek out? Are they things that caseworkers have told you about? How have you learned about them?
The TBRI through Utah Foster Care. It was offered. It's also, when we went for our first adoption, it was required.
Right.
And yeah, so that was when we first heard about that and the different trainings that are offered. I love their online trainings now. We fostered pre-COVID and post, and I like the in-person, but it's been so easy to get more information.
Right. Especially for one that's from a rural town. Like,
yes,
we're already at 2-hour training. You don't want to spend another 2 more driving to and from. So
exactly. Yeah. The virtual library has really opened up a lot. We've really enjoyed that. The local resources, and a lot of that was trial and error and finding it out ourselves with ABA therapies. That was my daughter actually applied for a job at one without really knowing what it was. And then she's, wow, mom, this is really great. And then from then on, yes, it is.
That's
so
cool.
It has been a lot, especially rurally. We've had to get a little creative. They just opened a couple of therapy options here in our town, which is huge, because for years we were traveling 3-4 times a week into St. George, driving an hour or more to make it to therapy appointments. So that has been really nice.
No kidding. Yeah. I can't imagine. Like, I've done the fostering thing, but you are next level. So I'm very impressed.
It's funny, too, to realize that there really are a lot of other foster families that are on the rural side.
Exactly. And that's why I think it's good to share and hear your perspective, because there are, one, so many families that are doing what you're doing. So to feel validated, right? And then so many families that want to, but maybe are concerned, like, ooh, we're kind of far away, or this, so I think it's
like,
really
I live in Kanab. How is this going to work?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So something I would love if you'd be willing to share is, what do you do on those days where it's just like, what am I doing with my life? Why did I sign up for this? This is really hard. Do you have any good tools or suggestions that you use as a foster adoptive parent that could help other foster adoptive parents?
I sit in my car a lot.
I love it. Okay. That's like your peaceful space.
Yes. My peaceful space. Waiting while they're in visits. Honestly, waiting for the end of a visit and you're there and you've done whatever shopping and you're sitting and waiting for him to hop in. I think those are the most vulnerable moments for me, because you sit and you start imagining, how is this case going to go? Do we get reunification? Yeah. What if we do? All the what ifs start to come in. And then all the questions, am I doing a good enough job? Have I found the right resources? Am I doing the right thing? So sitting alone in my car, I've seen a lot of tears. When it gets very overwhelming, I do have friends that I can talk to. And I think that that's really important. I like the mentoring system that has been set up. I participated in it on both sides. And then I have people that will call me in those same moments, say, hey, I'm overthinking, or did I do the right thing here? And making sure that you have somebody, and if you don't, to set something up with Michelle and get that mentoring relationship going with somebody has been really helpful. When I've gotten calls of children returning, those are very difficult calls. You hang up and you call your person, and then you can weep and cry and yell about how unfair and awful it is, and then call your RFC back and say yes.
What? Oh my gosh, the accuracy is...
Yes.
Look at nobody... I mean, people are so supportive, right? Most people are so supportive and so kind, but really no one gets it unless they've done it. And
that's true.
So having that mentoring relationship, you know, they don't even have to live in your same town, but like you say, just someone you can call and be like, oh my gosh, this is awful. But we're going to do it again. You know?
Yep.
We go.
And I am more prone to spill my guts and be emotional if I'm not in the same room with you. So having
telephones.
Really great.
That's true. I'm probably the same way. That's a very good perspective.
Yeah, I think that, and then also taking time for yourself. I know we're always told over and over, self-care, or care with your spouse. Make sure you're going on dates. Like to remind people that a date doesn't have to be, for us, drive an hour to a restaurant and stay 2 hours, and then we're gone for 7 hours. I didn't have respite to utilize the first 6 years that we did this because of the level of our children's and where we lived. A date with your husband can be sitting in the car while everybody's in bed and you're watching the house cameras. You can watch a movie on your phone. Self-care time for you can be, I'm going to remove myself from this loud room and just step outside for a minute. I have a couple of places where I can hide and still see the exits on the house and know that we are okay.
Yes, absolutely.
They don't have to be huge things to be impactful.
Right. I love that. That's a really good perspective. What would be something that, you know, not everyone can be a foster family, right? It's a big ask and not everybody wants to be, not everybody can be. That's totally fine. But what are ways that you've seen maybe in these rural communities that people can step up and can be supportive of local foster families or of Utah foster care in general?
I think the biggest way is to show up, even when you're not directly asked to. When we received a medically fragile infant from the NICU up in Salt Lake, drove up and picked her up. That was the scariest ride home of my life.
No kidding. You're like, is she still breathing?
This little 4-pound on oxygen and a feeding tube. I'm like, is she okay?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Every few minutes pulling over. But when I came back, my friend had set up a get-together where people brought everything I could possibly need for this little baby, even knowing that she reunified. We'll have to talk about that story because it's amazing.
I love it.
But she was with us for a year and a half, and I had everything I needed. I had all the diapers I needed. I had the clothing. And then I also had the show up and support. And I didn't ask her for that. Just did it. Then there have been different people on the friends list or mentor or through Utah Foster Care that sent a meal. Wow, you just got 5 kids. Here's a meal. Send it over. Or, you know what? We haven't seen you at our gatherings. Our cluster facilitator leader that would reach out and say, hey, I haven't seen you in a little while. What do you need? And to just be observant and to be there, I think is huge. Another thing that I've seen, especially lately as a struggle with foster parents, is we need more people in the community and in the churches or in the Boys and Girls Club or at Vacation Bible School that understand that our children are not going to have normal behavior patterns and to be okay with still having the children in their organizations or to make some changes where, okay, we can accept that or here's a one-on-one.
Yeah.
That I've seen that as a big struggle. And it's very defeating with parents because they can look at this child who was clear over here on day one. And now we're way up here and doing so good.
Yeah.
And so you enroll them in that class or the soccer camp or whatever it is. And suddenly they're clear over here again. to other people. And there have been dear friends of mine where the children have been sent home or banned or kicked out. Or I think that educating the community and those people that are supportive to parents, I think educating them and creating more spaces where children can be integrated without being left out.
I love that. I really hadn't thought about that, but you're right. There does need to be more trauma-informed education. Yep. It applies to not even just kids in foster care, but so many of our kids in these communities are coming from trauma backgrounds, whether we know it or not, and their behaviors are showing it.
Absolutely. And it can be from, like, we have the four-year-old that's still not potty trained and doesn't get it, or it could be the teenager that verbally says things that make you tilt your head, right, that may not be appropriate. But to be educated and to have a plan in place on how to work around those difficulties, I think would be monumental.
Yeah, I love that. Well, I would love if you would be willing to share this story about the medically fragile baby and the reunification. I think reunification stories are incredible, especially an infant that is very difficult to raise.
Yes.
An infant and then send that child back to their biological family. So if you're willing to share, that might be a great way to kind of wrap up our time together.
And it's my favorite story. About a year and a half after we opened our doors and started fostering, and I am so grateful that it was an early story for us, because the outcome was so unexpected and positive that it carried us through the very difficult outcomes that would come in the future.
Yeah.
So in 2020, right in the middle of COVID, all the schools were shut down, and we had just finished our level 3 training, and I messaged my RFC, do you have any medically fragile kids for us? We're ready. And she said, yes. Said, I've been sitting on this one because we didn't know if she would survive.
Oh,
so there
wow.
was a baby that was born in St. George, and she coded 3 times. They were able to bring her back, and she was life-flighted up to Salt Lake. And I was contacted and officially accepted the placement on the day that they were bringing her out of her medically induced coma. I got to go up. Her biological parents were not able to be up in Salt Lake or to be involved in her, in seeing her and her care at all at that time.
Yeah.
So I went up and stayed in the NICU with her for 5 days and then brought her home. She was a little trooper, all 4 pounds of her. And
wow.
she had exposure in utero to a lot of different substances. We had her home. She was on feeding tube and oxygen and medication, seizures, withdrawal. There was a lot going on with her. And there was a hesitation on the way home, where being in a rural area, the same thing.
Like,
I am an hour away from an emergency room.
Right.
How are we? Are we really okay with this? And I had lucked out. I was a paramedic for 9 years.
Okay.
So I had a lot of experience that way. So I had certifications, and I'd handed them in when we actually started fostering for neonatal resuscitation and for small children with medical needs. I had a lot of extra certifications, and that helped a lot. So we had her for about 6 weeks, and I got a phone call from my RFC, Lynette. She's not there anymore. I love Lynette. And she was checking in, and I could tell she had a question. I'm like, Lynette, are you asking me, does she have siblings? She's like, yeah, there's a boy and a girl. She's like, all right, of course, they need to be her baby sister. So they had been placed with an auntie who couldn't keep them anymore. So it was about 5 or 6 weeks they came into our home, and we had all 3 of them. They were 5'3" and newborn. And at the time, we had my biological 5 and the 15-year-old. We were up to 9 at that point, and we loved them. They fit in really well. There was a little bit of culture shifting. They are from Mexico originally, but they did speak English. I spoke a little bit of Spanish, so we kind of rushed to fill in that gap and help out a little bit. So because of COVID and because of the baby's fragile medical state, the older 2 had visits with their mom and their dad. But, and I really, it makes me sad that baby did not have a visit with her mom until she was about 4 months old. So mom had missed so much. And there was a lot of misinformation on both sides to me about mom's character and behaviors, and then also to mom about where her children were placed. So there was a lot of headbutting. And then right about 5 months, they decided that mom was safe and that she could start being around baby and have visits and coming to doctor's appointments as she was able to. At that point, we got put in a group chat with the caseworker and the mom and me. And the caseworker was not very optimistic. I can tell her story. She's shared it before at different forums. Andrea is an amazing woman, the mom, biological mom. But she had a very violent past. She's very hot-headed. And so we were in a group chat, and it was at that point, I was very anti-mom in this case. Other ones, I was like, yes, reunification has been amazing. And I had a lot of hate towards a woman, excuse me, that would allow these things in her child life. And at the same time, she had a lot of hate for a woman that would, in her eyes, that would be holding on to her children and not letting them go. And she felt like she wasn't getting anywhere in the case. And I met her. I met her face to face in the DCFS office in the visit rooms. And we did not like each other the first two or three times. And then it was time for a visit and the caseworker couldn't be there. Can you supervise? And I did. And I supervised with Sunshine. The baby's name is Sunshine. I love her name. And we had a real conversation that day, the two of us, with Sunshine about her care and how things were. She had a lot of questions. She talked a little bit about the case, but she was so genuine in her dedication to staying clean and to working to get her kids back. And I saw that for the first time when we were allowed to be alone together.
Yeah.
And from that day, we became a team. I still bawled like a baby when the older two, they got to reunify first. And I had Sunshine a little bit longer. So they reunified at a year because both of the parents were still clean and did everything they needed to do. And then at a year and a half, about 18 months, Andrea decided that instead of a quick, cold, give me my baby back, she stepped outside and said, what does my child need? And we were able to slowly transition Sunshine over to her care. She still had the feeding tube. She still had a lot of medical needs. So she kept her on the weekends and I had her during the week. And then we shifted and she had her during the week and we had weekends. And it was the most beautiful pattern for her to go home. My husband has, we might not put this in there, but just so you know, my husband is so connected with every child that comes in the home. When Sunshine went home, and we are for it, we love this family. They are clean. They are doing everything they need to do. But he actually, the night she went home, we thought he was having a heart attack.
Oh, gosh.
And it turned out, it turned out that it was broken heart syndrome,
yeah,
which is a real thing. You hear it about it. Are you kidding me? So he had, his heart was like, nope, you're not taking my baby, even though it was. That's the type of love that you want to have for every child that comes to your home. The type of love that will allow them to be whole with their families and then also have a heart attack because they're not here.
It is, that's so beautifully, tragically real.
It is so real. It is so real. But long story, Sunshine is 6 years old. June 14th. She is doing great. She doesn't have her feeding tube. She's still very small. She has Noonan syndrome, and there's still effects of exposure that comes in her behavior in her life. But her mom has been clean since June 14th, 2020, when she was born. That was her wake-up call. Her dad has been clean since then. And their family is together, and they live in the apartment right next to us, so we are able to see each other every day, and we co-parent together. When Sunny's having a rough day, Andrea will call me like, hey, your daughter.
All three,
even the older ones, I'm mom and Abe is dad, and then their parents are mama and baby. And
so cute. Wow.
It is so beautiful. Like I said, it was such a blessing. That story was early on so that I could process and learn those emotions and the hatred feelings and all of that, and then seeing these people as it could be me on the other
side. It could be any of us.
It could be any of us on the other side.
Yeah.
And seeing somebody willing to work and put it out there for their children. Some people just take a little bit longer to realize what they need to do.
Yeah.
And so there have been some reunifications that were not pretty and not hard. And they've come back into care in different situations. But That one is my favorite with Sunshine. And I do have permission to share the story and Andre and Sunshine's name. So,
yeah. Well, thank you. That is like the best way ever to wrap up, because that is a beautiful story and it encapsulates foster care so well. Putting in these hard months, years of caring and loving for kids and then giving them back because their parents worked really hard to get them back. And they have you, but it's beautiful.
It is. It is absolutely beautiful. Yeah. It's funny because right from day one, we've been about reunification. That was our goal. We didn't have plans to grow our family. We're very content where we were. And then we ended up doubling, because when you put in all that love and care and time and then reunification or family members aren't an option, of course. What else are you going to do?
I totally agree. Totally agree. Well, thank you so much for not only your time today, but all of the love and care that you're giving to so many kids in your community and the example that you are to your community. It really matters and it really makes a difference. So thank you for all that you're doing.
Thank you. And I appreciate you inviting me to this.
To learn more about foster care, head over to www.utahfostercare.org. Thanks for joining us.
This has been Fostering Conversations with Utah Foster Care. Thank you for joining us. For more information, go to www.utahfostercare.org. We'll see you next time.